From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As the nation hurtles toward arguably the most important presidential election of our lifetime, the influence and power of the religious right in American politics appears to be coming to a head. President Donald Trump is an unlikely messiah for Christian fundamentalists who seek a rollback of abortion rights, gay rights, women's rights, secularism, and more. But perhaps it ought not to surprise us. In her new book that she spent more than a decade researching, my guest Catherine Stewart writes, quote, "The religious right has become more focused and powerful, even as it is arguably less representative. It is not a social or cultural movement. It is a political movement, and its ultimate goal is power." Catherine Stewart has been reporting at the intersection of religion, politics, policy, and education for over a decade. She's contributed to the New York Times, American Prospect, Washington Post, The Atlantic, The Advocate, The Guardian, and Religious Dispatches. Her earlier book was called The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children. She joins me to discuss her new book. It's called The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. Welcome to the program, Catherine.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
So your first book was about the attempt by the religious right to infiltrate public education in America. How did that book and its topic catapult you into the investigation, the years-long investigation that resulted in this book?
Well, in 2009, I started researching the religious right's effort to infiltrate public education through various means, and also to undermine public education by depriving it of funds and support. And over the years, I kept on digging a little bit deeper. I was really stunned by the movement behind the sort of anti-public education groups, really stunned by their high level of strategic thinking, by their determination, by their coherence. And I just kept digging deeper. And the more I researched the issue, the more I realized that the attack on public education was really just one part of a broader attack on America as a constitutional democracy.
So you have spent several years now putting yourself into the spaces where these power brokers of the religious right are. I imagine that, reading your book is frightening. And imagine that as you put yourself there, it might have at times been a frightening thing to be among some of these movements. But give me a sense of how they view themselves, the Christian fundamentalist religious leaders in America, who include pastors of churches, who command these large congregations that hang on their every word. How do they view themselves in the American political sphere?
When you're talking about a large collection of people, you can't know, obviously, what's in all of their hearts. But I think many of them see their quest for power they often put it in religious terms, but they don't really see a contradiction between their quest for personal power and often actually sources of wealth and their sort of idea that they're doing this and have a religious justification for what they're doing. But, what's more important is that, what they may see as religious activism, the rest of us can recognize as partisan political agitation. I mean, over for decades, the movement's leaders have invested in all of the tools of modern campaign infrastructure, data initiatives, really broad and very powerful data initiatives, media platforms, messaging. They have effectively turned a large number of America's conservative leaning churches into what are essentially methods of almost like cells of a shadow political party. They deliver very sophisticated tools to these congregations through pastors who are affiliated with their sort of agenda, and they have been able to turn out the votes disproportionately in their favor. Much of my book is an effort to sort of get into the actual machinery of the movement, to talk about the legal advocacy groups that are to a large degree driving its agenda, to discuss some of the most powerful right-wing policy groups, to talk about the collection of most influential pastors who are involved in the movement and to show their political connections and things like that. And again, to explore those tools of data, media, and messaging, and really to show that this is a political movement, not really just a kind of a values a collection of people concerned with values.
We there was a time in this country when it didn't seem appropriate for a religious community to insert itself so boldly into politics. Churches are supposed to, on the face of it, be non-political spaces. They're supposed to be places of faith and worship. How do America's religious right-wing churches, how does the Christian fundamentalist movement that you write about insert itself into the political sphere, given that there are strict IRS rules, there are rules around nonprofits, there are rules about the kinds of things that groups can and cannot say about political races? I mean, anybody who's been in the nonprofit world, sort of on the progressive side, knows that one has to be very careful about how one speaks out.
Well, I'll just give you one example. This is one of the initiatives I discuss in a chapter of my book. I'm going to hold this up. It's called A Culture Impact Team Manual, How to Establish a Ministry at Your Church. And this is one of the many tools, these and voter guides and other tools that are delivered to conservative-leaning churches through pastor networks that are trying to sort of turn out the vote for the hyper-conservative candidates.
Culture Impact Teams. Wow, so CITs.
Culture Impact Teams. So the idea is that, you know, pastors aren't supposed to politic from the pulpit. This is one of the justifications for their tax exemptions. But what the organization, the Family Research Council, which is part of the distribution network of these culture impact teams, is that what they'll do is they'll tell pastors to get congregants to actually get other congregants to turn out the vote. And they give them very sophisticated tools to do that. They form teams of congregants within congregations that are supposed to tell other congregants the sort of biblical issues that matter in elections and then make sure that they vote the right way. Another way they do it is through data initiatives in which pastors have been given data tools that enable them to combine voter rolls so they can see who voted with registration lists in their own congregations, so they can see what percentage of their congregation voted in the last election, and they can actually look up and see which congregant voted or didn't vote. And then they give them very sophisticated tools designed to ensure that they turn out the vote for supposedly, you know, biblically correct candidates. A lot of this is done through pastor networks like Watchmen on the Wall. This is an organization that's an initiative of the Family Research Council, one of the leading policy groups of the religious right. It includes tens of thousands of affiliated pastors. And in advance of elections, they give them very sophisticated tools in order, the pastors who are part of these networks, very sophisticated tools that are designed to help turn out their congregations to vote.
Watchmen on the Wall. And I understand that there's very strong links to the Trump administration, specifically through Vice President Mike Pence.
Pence actually has a endorsement of the organization. Their website boasts an endorsement by Mike Pence and other Republican politicians. But I think the point to note, the larger point here, is that, you know, the Republican Party has become increasingly extreme, notably on issues like abortion, what they call so-called religious liberty, which is more and more a demand for taxpayer money, as well as their argument for the right of people with supposedly correct beliefs to discriminate against others. They're not tolerating any deviation on these core culture war issues, and that's how they turn out the vote. It's a movement that divides the insiders from the outsiders, the pure or the impure, and you're either in or you're out. And this is how you build an authoritarian movement. You don't build it through consensus and compromise. You build it by compelling everyone to adhere to these extreme and irrational positions. And then by, you know, insisting, of course, that they declare their unwavering fealty to an extreme and irrational leader. I mean, look at the Republican National Convention. It's all about Trump, isn't it?
Right. And they didn't even bother to adopt a platform. They've just adopted Trump's agenda. Now, one of the things that was quite a surprise to me that you point out in your book is how the agricultural industry is linked to the religious right in America. Tell me about this. I was quite surprised by this.
I wouldn't say the agricultural industry in total is linked by any means, but there are people within the Trump administration or people who are sort of have links to the movement that also happen to be in the agricultural business. I'm thinking about Sonny Perdue in particular. When I was researching my book, I attended a large agricultural fair in the San Joaquin Valley in California, in Tulare, and it was an anniversary celebration for Ralph Drollinger. He's the head of an organization called Capital Ministries. He targets political leaders at the highest echelons of power. He's been extraordinarily successful under the Trump administration. At least 12 out of 15 current and former members of Trump's cabinet have been members of his group. And Sonny Perdue was there. So it was a 20th anniversary celebration of his ministry, and he's celebrating all of his successes. And a lot of politicians were there, a lot of right-wing politicians, including Sonny Perdue, who is Trump's agricultural secretary. He was sort of one of the keynote speakers. So it was also held, I think, in a large agricultural fair because Drollinger got some of his earlier funding from various folks who happen to be sort of agribusiness leaders. And something that I think is really important to note about this is, you know, this is a business that, of course, relies on migrant labor, or many farms do, not all farms do, of course, but some of the larger agribusiness conglomerates rely on migrant labor. You know, there's a lot of sort of abuse of migrant labor that you see, and Ralph Drollinger, it sort of promotes a kind of ideology, as do other movement leaders, that are intensifying existing levels of economic inequality that promote power for business leaders and a kind of subservience for workers. And that's something that, you know, it's a kind of irony here that some of the fortunes that have gone into sort of funding his ministry, certainly early on in his career, were the beneficiaries of this type of economic ideology.
Let's talk about economics and the way in which some of the figures in the religious right see themselves as linked to the economic system. They, I imagine, consider themselves very much part of the free market ideologues who yet scramble for tax dollars and subsidies when it benefits them. They don't see this as hypocritical?
Not at all. It's really interesting. I was just, you know, as everybody else is probably these days, reading a little bit about Liberty University, and I realized it's like the sixth largest university recipient of, I think, federal dollars. It's like they
get
a lot of federal money. But yeah, you know, the expansiveness of the positions of movement leaders, such as Drollinger and others, on, you know, economic policy hits home the fact that this is a political movement and not merely a stance in the so-called culture war, as many people portray it as. You know, Drollinger himself promotes the idea that social welfare programs have no basis in scripture, and the theology that he promotes unabashedly favors the rich. He writes that God believes in deregulation and that laborers should, and the workforce should, quote unquote, submit to their bosses. He actually uses that term in one of his Bible studies. And by the way, you can see all of it on his website, it's catmin.org. He's not hiding any of it. And this is, of course, as we know, you know, music to the ears of the movement's plutocratic funders, many of whom rely on minimal workers' rights and economic and environmental deregulation to maintain and increase their profits. And it reflects the movement's longstanding alliance with certain moneyed interests and a kind of hostility to the notion of social and economic equality. I think the sort of degree to which the movement has allied itself with a pro-libertarian far-right economic wing of the Republican Party is often understated. People often portray this as a movement just preoccupied with things like same-sex marriage and abortion, but really a lot of it is about money, how the Bible favors low taxes and no taxes, how the Bible favors no regulation of government or low regulation of government, and how the government doesn't, you know, the Bible doesn't support funding the social safety net unless that money passes through churches first. And in many ways, this is the exact opposite interpretation of the Christian religion as many, and I think perhaps most American Christians understand it. I mean, we know many Christians, including many evangelicals, reject the politics of conquest and division that this movement represents.
Amazing. So we started out talking about public education and how your earlier book was focused on the religious rights infiltration of public education. In this book, you also discuss a little bit of that, because now, of course, we have Betsy DeVos as education secretary, who I think is quite symbolic of this intersection between the religious right and the education, public education system in this country. But how much of Trump's America has opened the door for the prevalence of Christianity and Christian right-wing views on science and things like evolution in public education. I mean, it's been almost 4 years of the Trump administration in power, so I imagine there's a lot to have studied there.
There's a lot to say about education and Betsy DeVos, who, as we all know, is the Secretary of Education. Her family stands at the intersection of these two family fortunes that actually helped build up the leading policy groups of the Christian right, including the Family Research Council, which we mentioned earlier. The Alliance Defending Freedom, which is the legal advocacy group that has been called sort of the legal juggernaut of the Christian right, and a host of others. So one of the ways that they're opening up the education for teaching, you know, inserting religion in the classroom is actually through vouchers, by decreasing the funding that goes to public schools and increasing the funding that goes to vouchers, many of which are teaching not just creationism, but also contempt for other faiths. I mean, we know that, voucher money that's going to religious schools, well, religious schools can do what they like. There's one religious school I featured in my new book, The Power Worshippers, which has in their handbook, they group together homosexuality and bisexuality and lesbianism with bestiality. I mean, it's really a mean thing to do.
Bestiality.
Horrible. They've grouped them together as grounds for expulsion, of course. And they also say that in their handbook, I don't have the exact wording in front of me, but essentially being a good student means being pro-life. So they actually, and they all, oh, there's another thing they do. They talk about in the handbook, the student handbook, and that parents are getting too, they talk about how, they talk about male headship. They have this whole thing like, you know, men should be leading their families and women have the responsibility to be the helpmeet for their husbands. So they kind of have this, you know, almost like male dominance, female subservience language.
Traditional so-called family values of basically patriarchy and misogyny.
Patriarchy. They have patriarchy in their student handbook. And this happens to be a school that is not only getting money through vouchers, but they actually got like a really substantial $1 million plus slice of the PPP money, the sort of paycheck protection grants, which, as we know, if they're spent in certain ways, people don't have to return the money. So Americans United for Separation of Church and State did a really interesting analysis of this money, and the amount, the grants are given in rough estimates, so it's hard to pinpoint the exact amounts of money, but something like billions of dollars flowed to private and religious schools, as much as I think $6.4 billion of that PPP money flowed to these private schools, which, as we know, are able to discriminate against LGBT students and others, students of other faiths. They can exclude them for all kinds of crazy reasons. and, you know, can teach whatever they like. So, you know, DeVos, you know, to go back to DeVos, she has had this long-standing interest in promoting school vouchers. She was a voucher activist for decades, actually. And she kind of has a religious, appears to have a religious motivation at it for her activism at a 2001 gathering of conservative philanthropists. She singled out education reform as a way to what she called advance God's kingdom. There was an interview that she and her husband gave, Richard DeVos Jr., and they said that school choice, which they were working toward, was going to lead to, quote, greater kingdom gain. Now, that's kind of, kingdom is a kind of, it's one of those buzzwords you hear if you spend enough time in this movement. Now, you know, they present their plans as a way to improve public education and give families choice, which all sounds quite good. We all want choices. But when you look at where her family foundation's money goes, you can see that it's supporting a far more expansive effort. It's they're trying to, you know, the money that they've spent to like people like G. James Kennedy, who's ran Coral Ridge Ministries, they gave $5.5 million. In 1986, he said that public schools were brainwashing children and godless secularism. So the people that their money supports decry public schools, issue statements that are contemptuous of public education. Many of the organizations their family has funded, such as the Acton Institute, are committed to sort of degrading or even destroying public education as we know it. So, you know, to appoint someone like this as the head of the Department of Education is really, it's really rich, isn't it?
So the movement is so well-funded, it's so highly organized, it's not representative, but they have a very outsized impact on the political system because they are so, so organized and so effective at convincing their congregants to vote in certain ways. It seems as though this is a movement that's, you know, now got, you know, they have a president in their pocket. It seems too frightening to counter. How does one, and do you explore in your book, how, you know, what the pushback is against this movement that's anti-democratic?
Well, I think that, you know, one thing that they have done, look, this is a movement that punches above its political weight because it's so organized and networks, they unify when necessary. And, you know, I think a way to get a handle on the numbers, you can look at the work of someone like George Barna. He's an evangelical pollster who says it's just 10% of the population are the most devoted religious right members, but they are the ones not only who turn out to vote, but become evangelists for the vote. They get their neighbors, their members of their church, people in their circle, they're, you know, agitating for the vote. These tools are available to all of us who oppose the politics of conquest and division. There are things we can do as individuals, and the things we can only do if we join together. The first one is unity. You know, I mean, the religious right would have gone nowhere had they engaged in sort of nitpicking about this one and that one. They knew when it was necessary to unify behind Trump. They knew that their power depended on it. Their sources of public money in many instances depended on it. And they knew that their power at the end of the day depends on that. And so they unified. And I think that's a tool that's available to all of us who oppose the politics of conquest and division. One thing they've done is they've trained their people, the sort of rank and file, not just to vote on the front runner. You know, they keep saying, we don't need a, you know, savior, we already have that. But they talk about judges. You know, in the run up to the election, I went to a number of the right-wing gatherings and strategy meetings, and I'd hear speakers say, this election is about judges, judges, judges. And I think that they're absolutely right. You know, Trump has appointed, closing in on 200. We're talking about, you know, the circuits. We're talking about federal courts, not just the Supreme Court. And people have to understand, you know, the front runner may not be someone you adore. They might have said something you didn't like at one time or maybe several times. And maybe they did something or voted a different way that you weren't crazy about. But at the end of the day, are they going to appoint someone to lead the Department of, you know, the a climate denial person who's going to lead like the Department of the Interior? Are they going to appoint justices who are committed to taking away our rights rather than affirming our rights? Are they going to appoint someone to lead the Department of Education who wants to improve public ed or someone who wants to destroy it? I mean, it's really not about the front runner. It's about many of the folks who are going to, you know, be in charge of our government.
It seems as so you're suggesting that my very, very nice neighbors who lived up the street from me, who attend a church, you know, one of these mega churches with political pastors, who may seem on the surface liberal, but they're well-behaved church members, may end up voting for Trump, even if they don't like him, don't agree what he stands for, because they know that the ultimate goal is to advance their religious agenda and they are disciplined about it.
Exactly. I mean, they may be told, we all, I certainly know people, I think most of us, if we have any, you know, people sort of in the sort of right or people who are conservative in our circles have said, well, I just have to, you know, save the babies. My pastor told me that I had to vote on abortion. If you can get people to vote on a single issue or on two or three issues, you can control their vote. And that's why, you know, these a lot of the leaders of the movement have been, you know, when they're talking to the rank and file, it's all abortion all the time. Abortion is the beginning and the end. They know they can control their vote. But, you know, I think the thing to bear in mind is that I think for a lot of the members of the rank and file, a substantial number of them do not support anything like a theocracy, and many of them would be unhappy to learn all of the details of what their leaders are proposing. Many of them aren't just voting on policy. So when they're voting for the candidate who promises to end abortion or promises to reunite church and state, or when they say themselves in America's Christian nation, they're not really aiming for fundamental ways in which our government is organized. They're really making a statement about themselves and, you know, what they value in themselves and who they are. So they're voting in a way on their identity. I think it's really helpful to engage with people across the political spectrum and try to show that, like, you know, perhaps, well, when you're voting for this, you're also getting that. You know, you maybe think you're voting to you know, preserve traditional marriage, and yet here you the leaders that you support are enacting economic policies that make it so much harder for working families to succeed. And how is that supporting family values? You know,
right.
But again, at the end of the day, you know, I don't think we're going to change the situation by only trying to you know persuade Trump voters. It's really about, you know, getting out people who reject the politics of conquest and division this movement represents, and unifying when necessary.
Well, Catherine, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Great to speak with you today.
My guest has been Catherine Stewart. She has reported at the intersection of religion, politics, policy, and education for over a decade. Her earlier book was called The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children. We've been discussing her new book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.